Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome everyone. Well, what do you do when your life is falling apart, when one bad situation piles on top of another and you sit there and think, you know what, I have had it. I can't take any more. I don't need one more thing to happen. Well, my first guest today offers some surefire ways of dealing with crisis and turbulent times in your life. I'll introduce her properly in just one moment. Coming up around 12:30, I'm pleased to have writer and broadcast journalist Anne de Leclerc joining us. She decided one day to turn an ordinary Monday into a day of silence. And little did she realize that she'd begun an inner voyage that literally would transform her life. It's a beautiful book, a beautiful story. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Daphne Rose Kingma. She's a six-time guest of the Oprah Winfrey Show. For more than 25 years, she's been doing emotional healing work with individuals and groups, as well as speaking, teaching, and leading workshops throughout the United States and Europe. She was dubbed the Love Doctor by the San Francisco Chronicle, and her best-selling books have sold more than a million copies, including Coming Apart, The Men We Never Knew, The Future of Love, The Nine Types of Lovers. Her latest work is described as a place to rest your soul in the midst of chaos. And she's joining us today to share the 10 things to do when your life falls apart. Daphne, welcome to the show. Did we lose our guest? After all that, we lost our guest. Okay, she's calling back, I think. I'm getting, I can't read lips, Eric. What did you say? I'm sorry.
I think we have her now.
Oh, okay.
I'm right here.
Okay, there you go.
Hi, Vicki.
Well, you missed your beautiful introduction there.
Well, I'm going to take your word that it's beautiful. I'm sure it was.
So, you've written this great book. It's called The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. It's an emotional and spiritual handbook. I want to start by looking at this. You say on your website that your mission is simple. I am here to teach people how to love. And I read that as a child, you were lying on your driveway out in the Midwest one day, and you decided you wanted to be a poet.
So,
How did all of this come together for you? How did you go from wanting to be a poet to doing the kind of work you're doing now?
Well, it was, as many journeys in life, kind of a circuitous one, but I actually still am a poet, and I loved always as a child to write, and then I realized I also had a tremendous love of people and of understanding what went on with them, and so after I finished college, I went to graduate school and got a degree in counseling psychology, and then I started working with people, and then people asked me, in particular one year, a client said to me, you know, I'm going through this terrible divorce and I don't know how to get through all the feelings of it. Is there a good book I can read? And I thought about it and I realized that there wasn't. And so that became my inspiration to write my first book, which is Coming Apart, which is kind of the classic on the emotional process of ending a relationship. It's sold hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies. And so that kind of launched me into directing my writing in this path of, you know, addressing people's relationship issues, the number of those books that you talked about, a book called The Men We Never Knew. And so I just got on this path of using my interest in writing, you know, to write these various psychological teaching books. But meanwhile, in the background, I have continued to be a poet and to write fiction and other things. But in alignment with my healing work with people, my therapy, I've, you know, really felt myself called to write these various books that, you know, address the issues of relationships and address the issues of how to become more loving human beings, because I think that's my calling somehow. It's been shown to be.
Right. You know, what struck me, Daphne, was when I was listening to this story, and you, your mother, actually, you told your mother after you were a kid lying in the driveway,
yes,
and said, you know what, I want to be a poet when I grow up. And she presented you with this beautiful book. Had she not done that, had she poo-pooed you, you could very well have taken a whole different path there.
Yes, isn't that a beautiful story? I think that story is my loving tribute to my mother for her sensitivity and willingness to let me be the child that I was, you know, and ultimately the person that I am. And I think that was an incredible gift, that I didn't have to fight to be that, you know. I didn't have to stand up against some conventional expectation of who I was supposed to be. And I consider myself very blessed and well-loved in that way. And I think perhaps that's why my mission has been to share love with people and to teach them about, you know, the skills of loving and the beauty of loving relationships, because in many ways I was well loved, and I consider that an extraordinary blessing and gift.
Right. Now, this book, the 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart, this is a transgression. It's a departure from your typical books.
I mean, yes, it is.
It's ultimately still all about love at the end of the day, but it is quite different. So tell us a little bit about this book and why you chose to write this kind of book now.
Well, it is, isn't it, Vicki? And I chose to write it. It was really kind of an action of love in response to a very suffering friend who came to visit me from far away after many hugely difficult things had happened to him. And he just said, you know, can I come and be with you in your beautiful town for a while and rest? And, you know, his wife had left him. He'd had a business reversal and lost his job and had to move again and found out about a serious illness that he was struggling with. And so as he was ready to return and face all these things, he said to me kind of in passing, well, Daphne, can you just make a list of 10 things I should do to get through all this? And I laughed like you did, Vicki, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is like asking me to write a book. And so, you know, it was really out of my loving concern for him that this was inspired. But also, I think, you know, he was kind of the template, the bellwether for what's going on for so many people. There's always a messenger, as we know, that mm-hmm. kind of stands for the masses. And I realized that all the people I was working with, too, in a very different way, were dealing with just huge external issues in their life, not so much with, you know, how can we have a better relationship, but how can this relationship survive the onslaught of the loss of the house or of our kids' illness or the fact that we both lost our jobs or the fact that we lost our house in the fire. And so in a way that was very different than anything I've seen before, I just was witnessing people going through huge, challenging crises and upheavals. And I always like to respond to, you know, what is, you know, what is being shown to me and, you know, by the people that I work with. And this was clearly being shown to me. The man kind of expressed it in a very crisp way, but this is what I think all of us are observing is going on.
Yes. I love the fact that in the introduction to the book, you say, you know, this book really is a hand to hold. Let me hold your hand. I'm privileged to hold your hand as you go through these difficult times. I want to take a quick break because I'd like to start looking at some of the steps that you talk about. And I'd rather just be on a flow while we're doing that.
Yes, that's lovely. Lovely.
So I have to say, I looked on your website too, and there's the most beautiful photograph of you. You have this very ethereal presence in that picture. It's really quite stunning on your website.
Oh, thank you, Vicki. Thank you so much.
So the book is called The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. It's an emotional and spiritual handbook. And my guest is Daphne Rose Kingmer. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we will be right back. You always want another one. I only wanted a job. And I was with a living. How am I gonna get through? How am I gonna get through? Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States.
At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, a roundtable discussion with some of the Pacific Northwest's finest and most creative best-selling writers. Find out where they think the publishing world is heading, why they formed Seattle7Writers.org, and how it's making a difference in the lives of many in the area. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Feed your mind and your body and spirit will follow. Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back. My guest in this segment is Daphne Rose Kingma. She's an emotional healer. She's a relationship expert. Her book's been described as In the Midst of Chaos, A Place to Give Your Soul a Place to Rest. It's called The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. And we're going to start looking at some of those 10 things in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So the first thing, Daphne, that I wanted to look at was, and this is quite unusual because we don't often hear this information. If you want to get through this crisis in your life, whatever that crisis is, however big it is, you will have to cry your heart out. Tell us what you mean.
Yes. I'm just really giving permission to people to shed their tears and have their grief and cry and do it without apology because, you know, what a crisis is always a frightening thing. There's usually a loss involved, and grief and tears are the natural physiological response to loss. But so often, particularly in our culture, we don't allow for that. It's like we got to keep a stiff upper lip and, you know, barrel on through and pull our socks up and, you know, just carry on. And so it just was very clear to me that right out of the starting gate, people needed to be reminded that, hey, you know, if you feel like crying, cry. It's a very natural response. And in fact, if you know, if your body is needing to cry and you hold it back, then what actually happens is you create tension in your body that really is not healthy and can ultimately express itself in other ways that aren't good at all.
Right. And if we suppress those negative emotions, it's hard for us to feel the good emotions too, isn't it?
It is. It is, because we're just holding everything in all directions. So people often feel, you know, that, oh my goodness, I don't want to cry because then I'm going to, you know, lose control. And if I start crying, I'll probably never stop. I mean, that is really the most common feeling that people have, which is, if I start crying, I'll never stop.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, instead of allowing themselves to get into this engaging process, people just, you know, clam up and clamp up. And it's really ultimately very destructive. So that's what I started out with, because I think, you know, it isn't always that people start crying at the beginning, but somewhere along the way, when you face the magnitude of what you're going through, it is an appropriate response, and it's really important for people to know that.
Yeah. I see tears as a safety valve, almost.
Yeah.
You know. Number two and number three, you say face your defaults and do something different.
Well, I use this word, this modern word, default, which is, you know, not fault, but it's like your default printer on your computer or your default typeface. It's like we all have this place in ourselves that we go to that's very familiar. It's a very familiar coping mechanism, you know, the one you always do, you know, run to the refrigerator, or pour yourself a drink, or, go numb on the couch, or, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, a determined one, like, well, I'll just work harder, or I'll get a second job, or I'll work nonstop, or whatever. And so, you know, but in a time of crisis, this way that you've developed for coping, and we've all developed a way of coping in response to the nature of our childhood, but that may not be the best way to respond now. And so, you know, I'm really encouraging people to get clear about what that is. What is that? And is that really the best thing for you? Is that what you're going to want to be doing here to get the most effective response? And very often when you take a look at that, you'll see that, no, it isn't. And, hey, maybe I should do something completely different here, something counterintuitive. You know, my impulse would be to, you know, go out and look for 15 jobs, but maybe, you know, what I really need to do is go down to the basement and start building bird cages in my wood shop. I don't know, but, you know, that's what I feel like doing, and that's something different, and who mm-hmm. knows? You know, and very often this kind of unpredictable and unfamiliar behavior leads to a solution that you wouldn't imagine ordinarily because you're out of your groove, and so new and different things can happen to you, and different solutions can be delivered to you through this, you know, wild risk-taking.
Right. We all know that we have to let go to move forward. There's a quote in here I'm going to read out of your book because I just love this. It's by Michael Peake, and he says, "Everything I've ever let go of has claw marks on it."
I know. Isn't that great? I couldn't resist putting that in.
But we do have this impulse to hold on to, and we can't do anything about moving forward until we let go, can we?
That's true, and it is so hard. I mean, I thought that was just a very good representation of how hard it is for so many of us because we feel like we're going to lose everything if we let go, and we're going to lose whatever we let go of, but of course that creates the space for something new to come in, and yet that last moment of letting go is often so challenging, whether it's a thing or a person or a way you've handled things or an idea of the way life is going to be. It's just really hard to surrender, you know,
mm-hmm.
and letting go is really an act of trust, and you know, I can just say that whenever there's a crisis time, a hard time, you know, there is something to let go of. I don't know what it is for each of us. It's a different thing, but we do get shown pretty clearly whatever it is, and, you know, then the challenge is to actually let go.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about, too, this is in Chapter 5, you say, remember who you've always been. And sometimes it's a little hard to do that when we have so much junk thrown at us at one time. We can start to second-guess ourselves, even.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, the emotional nature of any kind of devastating event is that we feel suddenly completely powerless, disoriented, paralyzed, you know. A lot of times we also feel self-blaming. But the big deal is that, you know, as paradoxical as it is when your world is falling apart around you, what you really do need to do is check in with yourself and say, well, you know, what are my internal resources? How have I made it through life? What's my particular talent that I can call on in this moment? And where would it lead me if I started relying on it?
Mm.
And we all have that. I mean, that's the good news of this book and why that's obviously one of the 10 things is to remind people. That's part of that hand-holding that you talked about. It's just that I want to take people's hand and say, hey, you know, you do have something inside you that you can rely on. And don't forget that because that's what will, you know, carry you through this journey toward, you know, whatever is coming next for you.
Right, right. Number 6 is persist. And I just want to read this. You say persistence is the spiritual grace that allows you to continue with optimism, even when you feel trapped in the pit of hell. And Step six leads into integrating your loss. And I wonder if you can talk about integrating your loss and what you mean, because most of us, if we have a loss, we don't want to integrate that into our lives. We want it to be a separate thing. So explain what you mean by that.
Well, yes, I mean that we have to realize and we have to take it into our awareness of our life and of ourselves, that the thing, whatever it is, has happened. Yes, my husband has left me, and I'm now a single woman who has to cope by myself. Yes, I did lose that job, and I'm never going to be able to go back there again. I have to move in a new direction. Yes, I have been designated as having this illness, and now that I do, I have to start taking care of myself differently. And, you know, we live in a great big culture of denial that wants to talk us out of everything, especially everything hard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can have everything you want, you can have it without paying for it, you can have it all the time, and there aren't going to be any consequences. This is kind of the trip we've been on. And so integrating is very different. It's like saying, yes, this is true, and this is now part of my life. And because I hold that in conscious awareness, I will also make my life different. My life will follow a different path, and I will be different as a consequence of being aware of this. You know, the man who says, wow, I just got diagnosed with diabetes, and now if I forget that, I could drop dead someday because I'm not paying attention to my insulin levels. But if I integrate that and bring it into awareness, then I become a person, or I certainly can become a person, who's very, you know, carefully aware of my health. And in fact, my health may be even better than it was before I received this diagnosis.
Mm. Important distinction there between letting go and acknowledgement, isn't there?
Yes. And it's paradoxical almost, you know, that we both need to let go and we need to integrate. It may seem like those are opposites, but they're not. One is surrendering what needs to be let go of, and one is being aware of what you need to be aware of, and you know, taking that awareness with you so that you behave differently as time goes on.
Right. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so I want to just get through. Number eight is live simply, and you're not talking about picking up a copy of Real Simple at the grocery store checkout. You're talking
right.
about really living simply. And
yeah, just, you know, we need to do that more. We need to ask ourselves what's really important, and we need to see if we need all the stuff and people and stimulation and food and drink and everything that we keep, you know, assaulting ourselves with. And when you pause, and a crisis is certainly an opportunity to do that, when you pause to look around, you have a chance of saying, hey, do I really want need all this stuff? Or, you know, would I rather have a conversation with my child or my lover, or, you know, sit down and read a book or have an extra hour of sleep? I mean, I'm shocked sometimes when I read about the amount of sleep that people get these days, and they're actually imagining they can function daily on 4 hours of sleep. And so part of that simplicity could just be like saying, you know, I'm not going to watch TV all night. I'm not going to read everything that comes my way. I'm just going to go to bed and have an hour of sleep. That's simplicity. So we need to do that in times of crisis, because we need to recollect our energy so mm-hmm. we can make it through the experience.
Right. And numbers nine, steps 9 and 10, go where the love is and live in the light of spirit. What would you like to leave our listeners with about those two segments?
Well, just that, of course, all these things that we go through are really to deepen ourselves and to put us in contact with our loving natures and to get us to be more loving and to allow us to receive more love, and also to look at the depth of our spirit, you know, that we're not just amassers of stuff. We are deep souls, and we're here on a journey. And when we connect with that truth, it's just amazing how everything kind of sorts itself out, and we come to a place of equanimity.
Mm.
So that's the ultimate, you know, that's the ultimate gift of these tough things that we go through. And I really want to encourage people to know that there is a place of peace at the end of the journey of difficulty.
What do you think of all of the things we've talked about in this very quick segment that's flown by?
Yeah.
What do you think is the most important thing for people to grasp?
Well, I think overall the most important is to realize that it's a process, and the internal most important thing is to realize that you're a very deep soul. And, you know, when life is over, these things are all going to be in the proper perspective, and you will be who you truly are. And somehow that brings great peace to people when they can connect with that truth.
Right. Well, listeners can find out more about you at DaphneKingma.com or at the10thingsbook.com.
Yes.
Yeah. Daphne yes. Rose Kingma, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure being with you, Vicki.
And again, my guest, Daphne Rose Kingma, her book, The 10 Things to Do When Your Life Falls Apart. It's an emotional and spiritual handbook. And the website's, again, DaphneKingma.com or the10thingsbook.com. And if you stay with us, we'll be joined by Anne LeClaire when we come back. Her book is called Listening Below the Noise, The Transformative Power of Silence. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune in to our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3, Alternative Talk 1150.
Silence, and in the naked light I saw.
Welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I don't care how old that song is, it is still powerful. My first guest, her book was described as In the Midst of Chaos, Give Your Soul a Place to Rest. And Luann Rice, author of Light of the Moon, describes my next guest's book as this is a book that heals the soul. A classic, it left me spellbound and stunned by its power. And my guest is Anne D. LeClaire. She's a former reporter, radio news broadcaster, and op-ed columnist whose works appeared in Red Book, the Boston Sunday Globe, and the New York Times, among other publications. She's the author of 8 novels, and translations of her work have been published in 24 countries. And she lives in the beautiful Cape Cod. Anne LeClaire, welcome.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you. And as will become clear in a moment, I'm glad that we caught you on a good Monday when you can talk to us. I want to start off, Anne, because this is, I was telling you before the show, this really is a very beautifully written book. You said it was written by the heart, from the heart, and it certainly shows. But I wanted to begin, Anne, by looking at how all of this began for you 17 years ago. You say that as a child, your favorite book was The Secret Garden, and you were forever looking for that secret garden. And one day in 1992, in middle age, you found your own secret garden. I wonder if you'd share with us what that's all about.
Certainly. And it's interesting because, as I said, as a child, I was completely fascinated and enamored with that book. And my grandfather lived in Boston, and I was always looking for a secret garden. And it was when I stopped looking for the secret garden that it came to me in that way that sometimes happens in life. I do live on Cape Cod, the other side of the country from you. And I was walking on the beach one day, thinking about my friend whose mother was dying, and watching some eider ducks, those beautiful black and white sea ducks, dive for food. And they stayed underwater so long, I tried to pattern my breath with theirs and couldn't do it. These ducks with lungs the size of my thumb were able to stay underwater longer than I could hold my breath. And that struck me in that moment as a miracle of nature. And you know, Vicki, when we're in that moment of like gratitude and appreciation, how it can just open us?
Mm-hmm.
And I was suddenly overwhelmed with gratitude for the beautiful place I live, for my life, for my family and my friends, for my work. I just love writing, and I'm so fortunate that this is, you know, the thing that I love most is what I do for a living. And I was just in that moment, because we know everything can change in an instant, in one doctor's phone call and one test result in a car accident, anything. It can all change. And in that moment, I was just grateful for that moment and the riches of my life. And I was grateful even for the sorrows I'd experienced, because I understood how they had made me who I am too. And I was so grateful. I said out loud on the beach, "I am so grateful, I don't know what to do." And a man behind me on the beach said, "Sit in silence."
Oh.
And when I turned around, there was no one there. And it was such a profound experience. Nothing like that had ever happened to me before.
Right.
Or I must say since. But it was so real and profound, and it was a voice outside my head. It wasn't like I heard it in my head, that I was struck by it and began to wonder what sit in silence could mean, and finally decided maybe it means just what it sounded like, be quiet. So I came home and told my husband I wasn't going to talk the next day. And that next day happened to be a Monday, and I did not talk, and it was such a truly, that first day, transformative experience that I knew I needed to do it again. And I did not know on that day I was beginning a practice that would continue to this day. But since that time, on the first and third Mondays of every month, I do not speak. And in the beginning, it was just that. I did not speak. And, of course, over the years, it's deepened and widened. And the original title I had thought of using for the book was Stone Falling Through Water, because of the rip. When a stone falls, it goes deep and changes things deep in the water, but it also sends ripples out. And it felt to me that that's exactly what silence has done in my life.
Yeah, amazing. Now, there might be some husbands listening out there thinking, boy, I wish my wife wouldn't talk a couple of times a month. but this, you know, tongue in cheek, I'm being, obviously. But this is has been a very powerful, transformative experience for you. I'm wondering if you'd share with our listeners, your husband was a little skeptical when you decided that you were going to make this a regular practice.
Well, he was. I mean, you're right. I often hear that response about, oh, how can I get my wife to do that? But he didn't like the idea. He said, and I think it is about being unavailable in some sense. And he said, what if my friend Margaret's mother was dying? And he said, what if Margaret's mother dies? And what if the children need you? And I said, I don't know. I don't know, but my intention is to not speak. And he didn't like it for a number of years. As he said, it was inconvenient, and it is. We're used to living in a certain way. We're used to having people available for us. We're not used to claiming any time, especially nowadays, I think, mm-hmm. where there's what I like to call a false urgency to our lives, where we think everything is immediately urgent. But after 5 years, one Sunday night, my husband said to me, you know, I didn't used to like your day of silence, but it has taught me something I need to know. Most things aren't that important.
Isn't that interesting?
We go through life thinking everything's important, everything's critical, and it's kind of all around a certain sense of self-importance. And by maintaining silence, I was able to strip away what truly isn't important and kind of prioritize what is.
Right. Well, there's a story that you share later in the book when your husband Hillary appears at your studio door and you're writing. And he says to you, I'm going to the post office. Do you need me to pick anything up? And you totally lose your train of thought, which one does when one's in a creative flow and somebody's interrupted. And there's a great quote that you use to illustrate that point. Henri Matisse once said, whoever wishes to devote himself to painting should begin by cutting out his tongue. And you quip there, or somebody else's, meaning your husband's. So, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut over you.
Well, I think, many, many artists and poets and composers have talked about the need for silence to create. And that certainly is one of the discoveries that I found, that on my silent days, my writing seemed to go much deeper. I would make connections because, in my mind, silence equates space. I mean, it's just as simple as that. And giving ourselves space to be, to sort things through, to think about some of the big questions that we really do need to think about to live a full and rich life, we don't often have that space anymore. And when there used to be, a Sabbath honored, that created space. When we did when there weren't as many technological advances and there wasn't email and text messaging and voicemail and all of that, it created kind of a space for reflection and a space to deepen, certainly, creative work. And that was one of the great early gifts that came to me around the practice of silence, was this space is very... I think we might think of silence as being kind of a deadened space, but in fact, it's quite lively. That space certainly changed my writing. It also, in a way that surprised me, I thought early on that perhaps silence would disconnect me from others, but in fact, it proved to be the river that connected me to others.
Oh, I love that, the river that connected you.
In one way, because in silence, not talking, I began to learn to listen.
So you do have communication. Do you sign communication at all, or do you really try to refrain from engaging?
That's an interesting question, Vicki, because engaging is such a rich word, and there's so many ways to engage. My preference has been to keep the silent days pretty quiet, not go out. But in 17 years, and especially in a life where I teach abroad, I teach in this country, often I'm traveling, so I am out in the world on silent days. I do have a card that says I'm having a day of silence, and I will nod, smile. I think scientists have shown that 80% of communication is nonverbal anyway.
Right, right.
But I try not to write notes unless they're absolutely mandatory. For instance, if I'm traveling and at the airport need to tell the ticket clerk something, I'll write it, but I... generally speaking, refrain from writing and kind of stay in this kind of bubble of silence. And it's just proved so valuable in so many ways, not the least of which is it is enormously restorative. And it's very pertinent to us. I mean, it's pertinent because the level of noise that we live with now, noise of all kinds, is damaging to our mental health and to our physical health.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you say that in the beginning of the book, you say over the years, you'd had many times where you had accidental silence, but to take it purposely, to be purposefully silent, created a whole new level of focus and understanding and that restorative power that you're just talking about. I want to take a quick break, and when we come back, you ran into a writer, an Iranian-born writer who's been living in exile in Paris since 1982. He had a whole different take on silence, and I want to talk about that when we come back. My guest in this segment is Anne D. LeClaire. Her book is called Listening Below the Noise, The Transformative Power of Silence. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Let's get it started. Ha! Let's get I'm Rich Hallstrom. Join me and my co-host Tim Humphrey every Monday at 1 p.m. here on Alternative Talk 1150 for Motivation with a Purpose, where we will tell the inspiring stories of people from all walks of life. Motivation with a Purpose every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk 1150.
Words are very
Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And yes, appropriately enough, we're conversations and we're talking about silence here, as my guest pointed out during the break. But Anne LeClaire is my guest, and her book, again, Listening Below the Noise. I want to ask you, Anne, about the story you share in the book. You ran into an Iranian-born writer who's been living in exile in Paris for a number of years. And he says to you, you talk about silence with passion and love, but it's easy for you. You're a middle-class white woman in America with a nice family and home. And you said, yes, his words irritated you. You felt chastised and judged. But for women in the East, he continued, silence is not so nice for them. Silence is a punishment. It's a means of suppression. How did you feel hearing those words?
Well, at first I just was defensive, but then I actually allowed them in, and then I wanted to talk to him more about that, because I knew if I was going to be writing about silence, it was important to write about all facets of it. And while my experience had been very, very rich and beautiful, for many of us, silence is not necessarily a positive. I mean, we've all experienced at one time or another that kind of icy or punishing silence. And Rezar told me that he had been in prison, and silence had been used as punishment, and to such an extent that they welcomed, and I thought this was so chilling, they welcomed even the sound of the footsteps of their guard, even though they knew it would mean they'd be tortured. At least there was sound. And that was probably the most dramatic experience that I have heard of the effect of the negative effect of silence.
Mm. Now, as you practice this, you've been practicing for 17 years, as we said, as your practice deepened on the first and the third Monday of every month, you found that your desire for solitude actually increased, that you desired it more. And you talk about going from speechlessness to solitude. What was the shift there for you?
Well, I think getting very comfortable in silence. I mean, there's a reason we run from silence in this culture. I think we tend to believe that we need noise and excitement and addiction to be fully alive. We've come to believe that, when in fact, to be fully alive is to be at peace in our own skin, in quietude, and we need to reclaim ourselves, and then we can give ourselves back to the world. And like the monk Thomas Merton, I found the more I actually sat in the quietude and got to know myself and found the peace there, the more I wanted it.
Mm. I could see that happening. I really could see that. I'm not afraid of silence or solitude myself. I quite enjoy it. Your husband shared a great story about how oak trees grow stronger when they are not grown in the forest because their root structure becomes stronger. And so you started to see your desire for solitude maybe not as representing a weakness, but wishing to grow stronger. Talk to us about that.
Well, as I say, the more I spent time in silence, the more I could really see who I was. Sometimes just by when I wasn't speaking and listening to other people in conversation, I would then observe my own mental reaction and got to know my smallness, my prejudices, my generosities, my love, how I thought. And with kind of the space there of not speaking but observing, I could more intimately know myself, know who I wanted to become. I could listen to others far more from a far more neutral place and actually then hear what people were saying and not with no obligation to respond. I could just listen without ego involvement, which was it's a remarkable way to listen, and I really think our world would be different if in business, in government, if there was some kind of an enforced five-minute rule before we had to speak.
Yes.
You know, when we're so reactive. We're just so reactive, and we live in a culture that doesn't, in large extent, support introspection and contemplation and reflection, and yet these are what's called for. And I was interested, the portion I heard of your previous guest talking about in times of crisis, and in times of crisis, what we most need is to get still, to get quiet, to reach that space where we can contemplate and reflect and access the wisdom that lies beneath noise.
Yes. I remember reading years ago that the actor Larry Hagman does not speak on Sunday, and I believe nobody's allowed to speak to him either.
That's right. And sometimes people, I've heard, you know, when I was doing the book tour, people would say, well, it's easy for you. You work at home. And in fact, there have been many people in the world who have practiced silence through the ages, who live a very active and engaged life. And Larry Hagman was one. Every Sunday he did not speak. Gandhi was silent every Monday.
Oh,
and this was even while he was like going to the United Nations or wherever he was. It was just, I think a lovely example.
Yeah.
And I'm forgetting his name, but there was a man who wrote a wonderful book about being in silence, and he was in silence for something like 17 years every day. And in that time, he got 2 college degrees, got married, had a child.
Wow.
There are so many ways to communicate, and drawing back from the noise that seems to surround every aspect of our lives and learning the lessons of stillness, which is to pay attention, to live in the moment, to have mindful speech, to listen deeply, leads to a healing of a physical and emotional healing, a relationship healing. Just remarkable.
Yeah, I can see that happening. Most of your stories, well, many of your stories are actually based around the beach. You obviously like to spend time on the beach. This particular lesson you learned when you were flying. You were trying to learn to fly. And you say that you learned about resistance from flying, about the fear. Well, tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Well, early on when I was getting my pilot's license, I did not like crosswind landings. I was afraid of the wind, and I was very resistant. So every time my instructor said we were going to go practice crosswind landings, I would tighten up and fight it. And then one day I went up to fly, and there was a crosswind, and I landed, and it was just easy. It was just easy, and I realized that all my resistance was built around fear. And when I surrendered the fear, the resistance was gone, and I became very adept at crosswind landings.
Interesting. Now, have you ever glided? Because I took a couple of lessons learning to glide, and when you're up there and they pop the roof off and they let you just glide in the airplane, you can hear nothing up there. It's fantastic.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful Except I get motion sickness.
Were you ill when you were flying?
No, when I came down, I actually came down. It took me an hour and a half. I laid down in the airport for an hour and a half before I could drive home. But apart from that, it was a wonderful experience. you talk about having to set boundaries, obviously, in the beginning, especially, I think. And you say that sometimes you'd feel guilty and other times you'd feel totally indignant. You know, what's the big deal? I'm just being silent for a day. How did you go about setting those boundaries for yourself?
Well, one thing that made it a little easier was, in some way early on for me, it wasn't about me, it was about silence. So it wasn't as if I were rejecting people. It was like, this is the time of silence. And for the most part, people really have respected that. And so it didn't feel too awkward. But however, you know, I think it. I don't like to genderize, but I do think women are brought up to be giving to others and mm-hmm. nurturing. And so it did feel awkward sometimes, as if I shouldn't take this time for myself. But when I see the results, when I lived the results, it was like we all need to take silence.
Mm.
And it was the opposite of a selfish act. In fact, sometimes I think perhaps the selfish thing is speech.
Yes. Yeah, maybe. Your husband now, this has been going on for such a long time, it's obviously very routine to him. Has he learned, apart from the fact that most things aren't important, has he learned anything about himself during this process?
Well, that's an interesting question. I should ask him that. I think he probably has. Because silence, whether we're experiencing it ourselves or someone else, is very instructive. I will tell you, this is my husband's story, but I gave a workshop on silence, and a woman, I think she's in her late 70s, decided that she was going to, for Lent, give up talking on Mondays all throughout Lent. And the first day, her husband was very supportive, but the next day she said, "John, how was that for you?" And he said, "I didn't like it." And he said, "I'll tell you why. I'm just so used to our conversing through the day and the companionship, but later in the day I realized that it was probably a good thing that you're doing this, because eventually one of us is going to be left alone and we better get comfortable with being in silence." And I thought that was very wise and very beautiful, and I think that is one of the great lessons that of the still space and practicing solitude, is that we do become comfortable, because ultimately we are alone.
Yeah, somebody once said to me a long time ago, we come into this world alone and we leave it alone, so we'd better learn to be alone at some point during life too.
An interesting thing for me is children seem to take to it quite naturally.
Oh, really? That is interesting.
Yeah, my experience has been that they're intrigued by it. In fact, a school in Massachusetts, the fifth graders went a whole day without speaking.
Interesting.
And at the end of the day, both the staff, faculty, and both staff, faculty, and students all said they wanted to do it again.
I bet they did. I can imagine that. Well, it's been a delight talking with you, and I thank you for sharing this your transformative journey with us. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Anne?
I guess that silence is one of the most powerful and accessible ways to experience the wisdom of our lives.
Yeah, I love
it. And it's free.
And it's free. It's free, folks. I love it. Well, this is a remarkable book. It's beautifully written. There's some lovely stories in here. And as I said to you, it's not schmaltzy. It's a really, really nice book. Anne Hood, author of The Knitting Circle, called it one of those rare books that finds its way into our hearts and stays there, working its magic again and again. Anne LeClaire, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Vicky.
And let's give out your website before you go. It's annleclaire.com, is that correct?
That's right, Anne, LeClaire, LeClaire.com. I like that LeClaire is talking to St. Clair.
I know. You've got ease, I don't have the ease. So thanks so much for being with us. And again,
thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Again, annleclaire.com is the website. And check it out. There's some. She has a blog on there and some really interesting stories on there. Well, I want to thank each of you for being with us today and spending this hour with us. Hope we've restored your soul a little today with both of our guests. If you'd like to share feedback on today's show, you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 495-7617, or at info@conversationslive.net. I want to thank Eric Ryder, as usual, for being keeping us live on the air today. And we'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, a roundtable discussion with some of the Pacific Northwest's finest and most creative best-selling writers. Find out where they think the publishing world is heading, why they formed Seattle7Writers.org, and how it's making a difference in the lives of many in the area. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.